Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us. Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. I'm Katie Beardsworth and this is Michael Pohl. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here.
Michael is a guitarist, conductor, and has recently completed his PhD. And he is here to talk to me about the various strands of his portfolio career with multiple strands, I should probably say. So we've got various things to talk about, haven't we? Why don't we start with your album, Seven String Bach, which was released last year and has recently hit 1 million streams. Would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Well, it's a bit surreal. I mean, as a classical guitarist, I mean, I think when I was recording the album that, you know, maybe a few people might like it. And so it's really been very humbling that there have been a few more people than expected who have decided to like it. But what was so great about that album is that it grew out of some of the research that I was doing for my doctorate about arranging Bach's music for a seven-string guitar. And in the context of doing it, I found a lot of support from really inspiring people on Kickstarter who came together to make the project happen in a way that I was excited about, by which I mean that I got a chance to record with the engineer who I really wanted to record with, called Lewis Jones, in a studio that I really wanted to record in with a fabulous producer. And it really felt like a project that allowed me to take advantage of what the mission of crowdfunding really is, in the sense that at least Kickstarter was founded with the idea that we should start from what the ideal version of anything that we would like to do or make looks like, and then back into it from there. And I really was an opportunity to do that. And I'm really pleased with the results. And I think that maybe is why it's found some broader attention as well.
That's a wonderful album, absolutely. Very, very much well deserved the million streams and hopefully a million more.
Yeah.
And is it the first album that you've had released?
That's the first proper album.
Yeah.
So there was a demo that I've done in the past, but this was the first.
Tell me about your experience then of having an album release, in particular, and getting to a million streams, because I think streaming is a big topic at the moment, obviously, for musicians and how that all works, and it can be a bit of a mystery.
Right, so I think streaming is a complicated topic because in the context of a recording, it's kind of come in as a way to counteract some of the challenges that we were having as an industry with copyright and with the legal versus illegal music market. And you know, Mr. Eck, who started Spotify, had basically the thesis, and I think the correct one, that until it was easier to stream than it was to download music illegally, that people were going to continue to download music illegally. So Spotify is that. His thesis was right. It's now enormous. Now, the challenge for an artist like me is that Spotify is not really a meaningful way of supporting the art. It's a great platform to help spread the word and to get the word out. But even at a million streams, a lot more sort of money, time, and energy goes into making the thing, the object, then comes back out of it still. So that's why I think other uses of the internet, I mean, crowdfunding sort of flips the script, right? So essentially people are buying physical copies or the equivalent of a physical copy of the album ahead of time. And so I think that's what makes the economics sort of possible. I had an incredible experience with Orchid Classics. I mean, they just did a fantastic job of you know, partnering to make sure that the album got to where it needed to go and got in front of the editors who needed to see it. And that, I think, is a big part of it, that partnerships are still so important here in the streaming world. And I know that at a systematic level as well. You know, there were a lot of companies who thought, oh, we could get rid of these record labels because what do they really do anyway? But actually, record labels are important in helping to, you know, to mediate the distribution of these materials. You know, record labels have their own audience. They have their own relationships with editors. And of course, it's wonderful to be able to do it oneself and to have that freedom. It's also great to be able to have a partnership and you know, both in terms of editorial help, but also in terms of, you know, having the right relationships and being able to work together to help a product find its audience. But I think that's sort of a separate issue from the challenges around streaming in the COVID age, because now for artists, streaming a performance, a live performance, is essentially making an object the same way you make a recording. So we have this interesting challenge where part of live performance is interacting with an audience and interpreting something and expressing something in a way that's also being received in a context, you know, so in a room or in open field or wherever it is, there are circumstances around that, and there's a specificity to that kind of communication. But when you try to make a live performance streamed, you necessarily lose, because, you know, streaming a live performance is making an object in a sense. You're making something that's much more similar to your recording than you are to, you know, a bunch of people in a room. And it's not that that's necessarily a negative. I mean, it can be a fabulous way to interact, especially now when we can't come together in person. So it's a wonderful, you know, remedy to the contemporary problem that we have. But it is a different thing. And I think that it can be hard for people to look clear-eyed at what they're doing when they're doing it. And I think that can be one of the challenges around streaming.
I completely agree. I actually think that one of the big outcomes of COVID and lockdown for classical music, and possibly, I'm sure, for other art forms as well, is sort of needing to define more clearly what is meant by certain different scenarios or situations of music making, of content, and so on and so forth. I think this was really key to the debate that went on in most people's minds, or between people, when lockdown first started, about whether you should or shouldn't put videos out of yourself, you know, performing in your living room. And people started doing it, and people, you know, that was great. And then some people didn't feel comfortable with it, or some people started to feel that it was too much and there was a really busy space and so on. And this is all, it's actually been through, in my opinion, a huge kind of step-by-step transition, that whole issue. I think you can see the way people have sort of changed their minds about it maybe several times and done different things, and now we're in a whole new phase again where, you know, I think there was a little period when lockdown was fairly kind of established and we all knew where we were, and everyone was like, we know what we think about this now, this is how we're going to do it. And now as live performance starts to reopen, and again recording this at the beginning of September 2020, that's where we are at the moment, is that live performance is technically possible but obviously still fraught with many potential problems to do with the economics of performing to a space where only a quarter of it's able to be filled, and so on and so forth, people in rooms, people together in different levels of vulnerability, and so on and so forth. And yeah, I think, again, we're now in another transitional place where it's less clear again. You know, some people who weren't that keen on streaming before are now thinking, oh, and by streaming in this case, I mean like putting things onto social media, not streaming on Spotify. People are maybe we should just wait for it to open up again. You know, maybe we've
judged it, but... But I mean, we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, just in the sense that, you know, one of the most rewarding things I've done since lockdown was a collaboration with, you know, a couple of musicians who are in very different places in the world. So Emily Ferguson is a flute player who's in New Hampshire. Elizabeth Ogonek is a composer in New York. Nico Namoradze is a pianist in Berlin. And Joao Joffre is an architect who was in Texas at the time, even though he's normally based in New York. He was sort of corona stuck in Texas. And we got to make something that was, you know, in an artificial sort of space, in the sense that we contrived a space for an online performance. And that for me felt very different from just sitting down with a guitar in the living room and playing in front of a camera. Now, it's not to say that one is necessarily better than the other, but it is what has been great about the necessity of finding other ways to communicate with audiences, is that we don't necessarily need to make a simulacrum of, you know, a live performance. So, you know, person, instrument, space. We can also, you know, create something new and something different. And so I guess there's also that opportunity for anyone who's willing to think a little bit differently about that.
Yeah, Absolutely, it really breeds creativity, doesn't it? And that project is, you know, I'd never seen a virtual space created like that before. So it was, you know, definitely had great value to, I think anyway, as a viewer, as a different kind of experience that maybe wouldn't have come about had we not been in that.
No, position. Certainly not. And also, I mean, for me as an artist, it was an incredible opportunity to sort of broaden my artistic horizons and work with people who I otherwise wouldn't necessarily have had a chance to work with. So that's also a wonderful sort of outcome, I think.
So to come back to streaming from the perspective of your disc on Spotify, what was your record label's involvement in that streaming success?
Oh, just that the label is instrumental in taking something that is a finished master and that they're interested in and making sure it crosses the desk of people, the right people who would be interested in this kind of thing. So in some ways it's a bit like a matchmaking relationship where you take something, you know, someone who has a particular set of skills and information about, you know, who the right people for this music are, and you pair it with that music and then you sort of hope for the best. And that's, I think, what that's been like.
Oh, that's great. It's great to have that kind of ongoing support, I think, because they've done further. It hasn't just all been about the release, has it? There's been around the 1 million streams. There was, you know, future push for it, which
yeah,
I think is really
important. There's a recognition, I think, in the industry that content that quote-unquote outperforms what you might expect it to perform. Well, that's the sort of thing that you should continue to be interested in, and you should ask yourself, why is that? You know, why is this thing not doing as well as it could, or why is this thing doing better than we thought it might? And I think that, you know, Matt Trussler, who runs Orchid, does a great job of, you know, he's an artist himself. He was a professional violinist for a very long time. He trained at Curtis and was a very, very fine player. And he has a sense of, you know, what goes where and why. And so I think that's a big asset.
Absolutely. Oh, that's great. Right. And another thing that you do, which I didn't even mention in your introduction, is that you program a series of concerts for Lancaster Arts, right? Would you like to talk about that? You know, given that obviously it's an odd year for being a programmer.
It is a very odd year to be a programmer. So, you know, in a normal season, we would have been programmed, you know, many months or even over a year out from the performances. But this year, just because of the nature of how uncertain things have been, when it came time to start thinking about that in February, it already started looking like things were not going to go ahead as normal for the 2020-21 season. So we spent a lot of time on hold, sort of waiting to see what would happen. But very fortunately, the series is up in Lancaster, and live performances have been approved. So we're very fortunate to have a concert hall that seats over 600 people under good circumstances. So for social distancing, we can get 140 people in there. And that means that for the right kind of classical concert, there's an opportunity to present people live, but in a socially distanced and safe way.
Great.
So we're working on that for the autumn season. Lancaster Arts works on a theme. So I work with a programming committee and a programming team that decide on the theme. And then it's my responsibility to help suggest artists who might be able to present a program that is appropriate for that theme and is appropriate for the venue and for the arts organization writ large.
Brilliant. What is the theme this year?
The theme this autumn was supposed to be water, but because of the nature of the pandemic and the crisis, it's been changed to reflect the other strands of art being made by Lancaster Arts. And so the theme has been called Breathing Space. So it's about what it means to have the space to do something or not. And the beauty of this theme is that it's put to artists to interpret, you know, on their own.
That's a great theme. I've worked with themes as a programmer as well. I've worked with themes a lot, and I love one that is as open as possible. You know, some people don't like themes at all. I'm not against them, but I do think ones that allow for really creative interpretation are by far the best. And that's already mind filling with the ideas there. That one, that's absolutely brilliant.
Yes, I'm very lucky that there's a good theme and good opportunity to program to it.
So something that we get asked a lot at Polyphony Arts, in our support that we do for kind of up and coming artists, is how programmers make decisions. Obviously, that's quite a big question, but have you got any kind of
absolutely
tips or thoughts?
Well, so just to give a bit of context, so when I'm thinking about artists, first I'm thinking about fit. So I think as a programmer, it really helps if I am aware of the artist's work. So obviously it's a chicken and an egg problem, right? Because if you are a programmer, or if you're a young artist starting and you're trying to get the attention of programmers, it really helps for them to have seen you live or to have heard you play live. Now, of course, if you're not playing a ton of concerts, it can be really hard to find out, you know, to get someone to come along and to make it work, because oftentimes, you know, my programming obligations are relatively constrained compared to some programmers who are planning, you know, 30, 50, 100, 150 concerts a year in the context of Wigmore Hall. And so that's part of the challenge, is how do you get people to become aware of your work and what you're doing. But the other thing is that in the context of Lancaster, they are very receptive to people who are able to tailor their requests specifically to the person and to the theme. So if one were pitching to Lancaster, it's probably a good idea to be very specific in what you offer and to have a request. Now, it's obviously not true for all arts organizations. Some people just want a finished product that they can click go on. Lancaster isn't exactly that way. So what you pitch really matters to them. So that's the second thing I'd say. The third thing I'd say is that it's tricky because you're not pitching in a vacuum. So even if I love something, I'm also pitching up the chain to my programming team. But I think that it might be a really good thing for artists who are up and coming to know, which is that if you have a great thing and I think it's great as well, you need to arm me with the tools to then pitch that further, right? So you need to give me what I need to know in order to go to bat for you. And then the last thing that I think is a challenge for young artists is they don't realize what a problem it is for us, even after we've agreed to take something, to have press materials ready to go and available on your website. So a narrative bio that tells me the story of your life is frustrating and costs me time and energy. So unless I've worked with you, you know, 50 times in the past, or I really love you, or I owe you a huge favor, it's you're asking a lot as an artist to ask me to wade through that. So, you know, a biography that's, you know, professionally written, look at other, you know, major artist bios and copy that essentially as a format. Press quotations are useful if you have them. Good publicity photos that are available and easily downloadable from your website. You know, basically just think about all the things that I would need both to pitch you, and then once the team approves you, to put you without a huge amount of work into marketing materials. Because then my programming team, sort of ironically, is pitching you to an audience. So there's this, you know, you're pitching to me, I'm pitching to the programming team says okay, but then the marketing person has to pitch it to the subscribers. And I guess part of that can feel anti-artistic for a young artist because you're, well, it's not my responsibility, but the challenge is then whose responsibility is it, right? So the marketing person can only pitch to audiences with good ammunition. And with no audiences, the presenting organization ceases to exist. So, you know, you really have to see yourself as part of this ecosystem, I think.
I really couldn't agree more about that. That's just such a really great way of putting it. And I used to find, I still do find, the frustrations if you know something's going to be great, but it hasn't been sent to you. Or I suppose to flip it, how great it is when you know something's going to be great and what you actually receive is some text and some pictures that you could literally almost slot into a brochure like that. That, as you said, points an artist all the way through the process. And it does make a huge difference. The other thing that I think is important about what you said is the idea of having to know somebody, because this is something that I think is really problematic with for artists trying to work out how to pitch themselves in a busy marketplace. Is trying to work out what information to give to people. And I think, you know, it's interesting what you said about the biography, because in my opinion, I actually was I've been considering the biography element of marketing material is almost obsolete, or really only needed to be like right in the background, because they don't really tell you a lot, do they? Yes, they tell you where you've played and what you've played, but you know, there's something about the way social media, for instance, can be used to really depict a personality or a cause or a real sense of like, I'm really passionate about this type of music or this type of art or people or whatever. And it's that like finding of the bits of your personality that you want to share and making sure that people can see that in what you're doing, which I think is both more possible than it's ever been before, but also, you know, potentially it's something that feels overwhelming for young artists again coming into this marketplace and thinking, you know, how do I do this?
I mean, I think though that can be taken too far the other direction. I mean, I want to see an artist's personality in what they are expressing through their art and not necessarily in how they've written their bio. Obviously it gives a sense of taste and what might be important to that person, and that's I guess that's wonderful. But in written materials, in press materials, I expect a certain level of professionalism, because that's going to indicate to me what the booking process and what working with this artist is going to be like, right? So I'm going to trust you with my audience, with my money, and with my series, and you as an artist performing on it are sort of stewarding all of that for me as my proxy, right? Because if you do well, I'm going to do well. If you do poorly, you know, that's going to reflect back negatively on me. So it's the same way that, you know, people used to make a big fuss about rock and roll musicians who would put, you know, a ridiculous ask in their rider. And that got seen as this, you know, sort of absurd, you know, artistic thing. Actually, it wasn't. So that it was a test to see whether people had read the rider. Because if someone had read the rider, it was likely that the stage was going to be correctly set up, there were going to be no electricity problems, the crowd management was going to be well done. You know, all of the things that the artist needed to succeed were going to be fulfilled if a presenter had carefully read the rider. And so those crazy asks for blue M&Ms started as that. And it's sort of the opposite for me, right? So that I'm not the artist with the crazy rider, I'm the programmer. But if I see that your things are in order and you answer emails efficiently and there's someone who can answer questions for you, whether that's you or, you know, your uncle or your aunt or your agent, and there's a, you know, clear and quick communication and, you know, all these sorts of things, and that your bio is written clearly and that your website is in decent shape, I can be fairly certain that, you know, when you show up on the day, I'm going to get what I expect. And I think when I was a young artist just starting out, I didn't fully appreciate the way in which programmers' reputations are sort of on the line. And that can be a very conservatizing force. It can cause programmers to go after the same artists, you know, who are famous year after year, because if something doesn't go right, they can go to their audience, well, you know, this person's really famous, I don't know, you know, it's not on me, it's, you know, this artist is an entity unto him or herself.
I think it's really easy as a programmer to go with who you know, whether it's who you know personally or who you've heard of, because you do get a lot of information, don't you? You know, there is, I'm sure you found this since you've been working for Lancaster, certainly on the programming work that I do, I get, it's just people like sort of magically know that you're doing it all of a sudden and start sending you things. And so, right. You know, I think the clarity and the quality of the information that you're being sent absolutely is key and really important. And, you know, there's a train of thought that says that it shouldn't be as important as the actual musical product. And I would say, I mean, I agree with that train of thought, but I do think that it's a lot harder to produce a brilliant musical product than it is to produce a well-written set of publicity material. So right. If it's really not your forte, you just need to find someone whose forte it is and get them to help you. Because, right. You know, if you're, you know, the next genius violinist, that's a lot harder to create than a compelling pitch.
And even it extends to other languages also. I mean, when I've played in Italy or in France, I mean, I speak those languages, but not as a native speaker. So I'm sure that there will be mistakes, not only in what I say, but in how I say it. And so you absolutely must get a native speaker who sort of is aware of the industry to have a look at your biography in those languages and to look at your materials and, you know, pay them if you have to or buy them a drink. But it's just so essential in terms of getting it right for that audience in that context.
Absolutely.
But also, you've done a lot of programming, Katie, so I want to ask you about your thoughts on it.
Well, the same question.
Well, obviously, I think, or I don't know, but it sounds like we agree on a lot of the issues of, you know, get your materials in order, be thoughtful in what you're asking or offering of a programmer, understand that it's busy, understand, you know, what the process is, that you often have to pitch up the chain. But when you are thinking about who to bring, you know, what are the things that factor into your decisions?
I mean, I basically agree with what you said. It's a question of looking at whatever the parameters are of the series that you're programming and trying to find the information or the work rather that fits best into that. I'm really acutely aware as a programmer of how blinkered that can be depending on what information, first of all, I happen to know about anyway because of my sort of general sphere. Secondly, what people have sent to me, you know, because for every email that's sent to me, there are probably 20 that aren't, if you know what I mean. And also what I'm asking for as a promoter. I'm part of the reason I wanted to do this podcast is because I want to look at how music promoters and musicians can work together to make the music industry fairer. And I think that how people get booked for gigs is almost inevitably unfair in some ways, sure, because just like kind of fame and profile and so on has so much to do with that. And that isn't entirely and inextricably linked with quality. Obviously,
right. There
is a great deal out there that's quality and famous, but there's also a great deal out there that's quality and not famous, and that
right.
can be for all kinds of reasons. So what I would like to see and what I would like to do, and I will be completely candid and say that I don't do this at the moment, but it's on my mind, is like what Lancaster do and what I have done once before, is to release in really clear information about what I'm looking for and when I'm looking for it, and
right.
make sure that the artistic community knows how they can tell me what they're doing, because obviously I get contacted all the time by people at various points just being like, I'm doing a round of pitching, so I'm going to send you some stuff. So my ideal that I'm hoping to put in place and would certainly like to see more of, and it does happen as well, I've seen this done, is to have a clear place on the website which says, if you would like to perform for this concert society, what I want from you is for you to email me in December with some information like this, and then I will get back to everyone in an ideal world and explain, you know, and you know, so on and so forth. And I try so hard to reply to all the emails I get, and I couldn't sadly possibly say that I manage it, but I really do try because I know how much work goes into them. Obviously, I'm also an agent, so I see the other side of it. So I know how good it is to be in touch with people. But the other thing that I would, so that's like, I think that's my idea. I actually think that's kind of it's almost the responsible thing that the music organization side of the industry can do to make it easier for artists, so that it doesn't feel like a kind of confusing, busy space. And the other thing that I think about programming is that I've almost never not programmed somebody. I can't think of a time when I've ever looked at something and gone, well, I'm not going to program that because it's just not good enough. Mm. It's more because like it doesn't fit, or it's just sheer volume or
right.
something like that. And I just think like there's this horrible sense, especially if you're an artist sending out your own pitches, if you don't get a reply, you just think it must have like come across horribly, or, you know, so on and so forth. So yes, there are things you can do to make it come across better without question. But essentially, you know, that is the sad fact of it, is that there tends not to be like a sort of thing you could do wrong. It's just that it's somehow not made it up to the top of the list that time.
Right.
Do you think that? Yeah.
So there's, I think I got sort of distracted in answering your question about, you know, what is a programmer's perspective for, say, someone who's just starting out? But also, there is just the programmer's perspective, period, which is that part of my job is to create a sort of balanced diet within the theme
mm.
for the audience. So that means diversity of instrument, of genre, of repertoire, of, you know, kind in the sense that, you know, what is this going to be like? And having, you know, offering different kinds of experiences. And so it really is a question of sort of fit sometimes, which can be, it's not luck, but it's just right thing, right time. So I guess there is luck in that sense, that you happen to be doing something that season that fits the theme and that sort of fits in the bigger picture of the calendar, and it fits with what the, you know, curator of the gallery is doing on, you know, the 28th of November, and you happen to be free, and it's all this sort of stuff that in that has to work.
And when you're talking about fit, that's why it's so important to tailor. I'm now like explicitly talking to people who might be pitching, but it's so important to tailor pitches that you send in as much as you possibly can, because I've literally had it happen before where I had a gap for one of the series that I programmed for, and something had got cancelled, and I had an exact date that I needed a string quartet for, and a string quartet that was not on my radar at all emailed me and said, "We are free on this date," and I was like, "Oh, right." And I have to say, at that, obviously, I didn't then at that point go through all of the other string quartets that I had in my arsenal, because that was so easy and it was a slight emergency, and this string quartet were amazing, and you know, it was great. It worked out perfectly. And you know, if they hadn't have mentioned, you know, "We've got this date available," then that wouldn't have clicked quite that same way for me at that moment.
Right. And it's a tricky balance, because you sort of, as an artist, and I don't do this well, and I think there are a lot of areas of things that I've just spoken about where I could really use to take my own advice, but I think that there is this balance of wanting to contact people and wanting to keep in touch, but not wanting to pester somebody. So you really have to be sensitive to that, but also, you know, try to stay on somebody's radar, I think. And that's, you know, it can be tricky, but even, there's, I don't know how to do that exactly, but that's the balance that you have to strike.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the advice that I tend to give about that is basically to keep it genuine. I don't think you can go far wrong if you keep it genuine. So if you literally have really exciting news every 2 weeks or every month or something like that, and you've got someone kind of, and you can be like, "Oh, and now this is happening, and I just wanted to keep in touch and tell you." I think if someone is interested in what you're doing, they can't really get sick of that. And it's a little bit like the marketing principle, where it's like, you know, people, marketers can go really wrong by trying to get people who are not really that interested in their product interested in it, by diluting their marketing to the extent that the people who would be really interested, like, don't really get what it's about.
Right.
I think there's something about speaking to the, you know, bit like owning the fact that you have, you know, a space to occupy and a personality, or, you know, a sense of what it is you're trying to do, and being unapologetically available in that space. And if people really don't want to hear about it, they'll just unsubscribe from your emails, or like ignore them, or tell you no. But more often than not, like, there is nobody, I can say this genuinely, there's nobody that emails me about their artistic work that I'm just not interested in at all. It's just either come at the wrong time, or it's not as high priority as something else.
Right.
But, you know, I think most people are generally quite well-meaning about this sort of thing.
Yeah, the other thing that it just popped into my head when I heard you say that about the issue of artistic quality is that I got really great advice when I was 22 years old from Clive Gillinson, who used to run, he was a cellist who ran the LSO, and now he runs Carnegie Hall in New York. And he, you know, part of his mission is to make a few minutes to see young artists as they're just starting out, and I was really lucky to get some time with him. And the advice has stuck with me to today, which is that, you know, lead with the quality of your art, you know, make something extraordinary. And if that's your focus and your mission and what you strive for in your work, everything else will be that much easier. Now, of course, that's not to say that everything falls into place. And I think his perspective actually has developed and changed as well, at least is my impression, from having now run Ensemble Connect, you know, in partnership with Juilliard and I think the Weill Music Institute, but don't quote me. And seeing, you know, how tricky it can be, even for some of the most extraordinary young artists, to get traction in the industry and to get footing. And I think it's something that people, you know, the more agents now I know and the more artists I know, that it's a difficult career and a difficult trajectory for that reason, that there's not necessarily a magic bullet, even for a mid-career artist, to, you know, and things are difficult. It can be hard to stay active in the industry. So, but I guess I was really grateful for Clive's advice to that effect starting out, because it allowed me to sort of refine my focus and my mission into, you know, doing one thing extremely, extremely well. And of course, there are a lot of things I do, but if I'm going to do a thing in public for people, I try to really focus on that aspect of it.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I think you do a lot of things for someone who's focusing on one thing extremely well. But I don't understand what you mean.
But meaning that, you know, some people, I think I should refine, I think there's the interest there potentially just because in what I play on the guitar, for example, I'm interested in particular repertoire and collaborations and programs that are really valuable to me, just because anything that I do on the instrument is something that I really, really want to be doing. Now, you know, with conducting, I think I'm more of an open book. You know, somebody says, oh, can you do this thing? Absolutely. You know, the other thing, fine. It's an omnivorous opportunity, partially because once you can read a score fluidly and once you sort of speak multiple languages with, you know, a different vernacular or a different ability to communicate within that framework or and have a sense of how you want to express that style, that the upstart cost of learning a new orchestral score is much lower for me than learning a new guitar piece to perform in public, you know, especially a Bach suite or something like that. You know, a suite's going to take me a year or a few years to really inhabit it and to feel good about. Whereas learning an orchestral score, you know, is days, weeks, or months, depending on the complexity and length of the score.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm able to focus deeply on the guitar, broadly on conducting, and then I have other things that I do that nourish me outside. So these other interests in research or in programming, but that I have a very clear-eyed sense of what it is that I want to do and why I want to be doing it. Now, that's not to say that I don't get battered a bit back and forth by, you know, oh, this opportunity or that opportunity, but there is a sense of, right, I'm taking this because I want to do it for this reason, or I'm not, because there's an opportunity cost to that. So in the sense that the thing that I'm not doing is also taking me away from the thing that I want to be doing.
That's a really good perspective to have. Definitely.
And so for a young artist, for instance, if you're getting pulled in all these sorts of different directions, at some point, if you really know that, you know, being a soloist or having an agent and being in a small chamber ensemble and these sorts of things is for you, and you're really certain that you want this kind of itinerant lifestyle where you're never really home and you're always kind of on the road and all these sorts of, you know, things that go with it, that's for you, then the question has to become, well, what are the things that I have to stop doing in order to make that possible? And, you know, what is the focus that this is going to require? What do I have to say no to make this work?
Yeah, absolutely. I really agree with everything about that, really. So do you think that would you say that all of the strands of your career are kind of around and focused around the Bach project, you know, and then it all just kind of, because, you know, you mentioned at the beginning that it tied to the PhD, which we've not talked about yet, but, you know, that it's all interlinked, isn't it?
Well, in a sense, yes and no, because I think there, if everything I were as an artist were about Bach, I would really kind of be flat. So,
but that's not quite what I meant, because you're absolutely right. But if your focus is going to be on the guitar, the Bach suites, that doesn't mean that you only play that. It just, you know, everything
For me, for right now, that's accurate. That my focus on the guitar as a soloist is to play the 7-string guitar and to play Bach. Now, there's also a parallel strand of 6-string stuff. So I was focused last season on new American music. I was supposed to be focused this season on sort of 20th century and a little bit of new British music and music from the British Isles. That is on hold a bit because of the pandemic. But by organizing, having sort of different strands that I'm focused on, I know what they are, I know why I'm doing them, allows me to stay focused on that dimension. Now, in terms of the holistic thing, there is something, one of the reasons I was interested in Bach is that my working hypothesis is that it's very difficult to do well as a soloist. And I wanted to do it at the beginning of my career because I also thought it would teach me things about other repertoire. And so far, so good. I think I've been sort of fulfilled in that expectation or vindicated in that thesis, just because in writing about Bach and about researching what it means So my doctorate's about applied rhetorics, which is a sort of way of applying aesthetics in the sense that rhetoric was the framework through which people, you know, before about 1740, all thought about music from about the time of Monteverdi till about then, in the sense that they saw it as an organizing principle. But, you know, when I look at that with my modern eyes, I see that differently than someone who was living there did. But by thinking about that framework and by thinking about Bach's music in the context of that framework, I learned a lot about what's important to him and, by extension, what's important in composition. So I sort of taught myself about composition, you know, because every now and then I'll write a piece, so I really wanted to learn that. I learned a lot about, you know, expression, because I learned that there are all these different things that impact a performance. So there's the framework, there's the overarching set of assumptions that we make about what a performance is and how to do it. Then there's the intent, so what kind of thing do we want to do? So you see, like, historically informed performance or historically inspired performance, that's a statement of intent. You know, no instrument that we have today is truly and thoroughly historical, you know, because it's a tool.
Because the audience isn't listening to it with historical ears.
Right, and that's a question of perception. Yeah. So there are all these issues. So there's framework, there's intent, there is the tools that we use, so the instrument, there's the style, so the vernacular that we use, where we put the stress. So if all of a sudden I stop talking like this, the way in which I'm pronouncing the same syllables and words makes you have a completely different experience of who I am.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. I mean,
absolutely.
And it's the same in music, that style is an expression of how we say, you know, how we say the longs and the shorts, how we emphasize them, whether we put emphasis on the bar line or whether we shoot for a long phrase or something in between. And then, as you say, perception. So all of these issues have, for me, coalesced around Bach, but they're equally relevant to Schubert or Mozart or, you know, Britten or anybody, really.
Oh, absolutely. Sorry, I was just listening to you talk about that. It's just so fascinating. Yeah.
So that was all a very long and kind of roundabout answer to your question of, does it all link back together? And so in that sense,
yeah.
Yes. And then also because the playing, you know, having to express all of these ideas on the instrument, that's the same sort of set of artistic tools that then get applied to conducting, right? So, you know, when I conduct, I have to, all that I have is the force of my ear, my preparation, and then some hopefully coherent sense of gesture that allows someone to, you know, allows for us to be on the same page. But, you know, that's the same, the challenge of expression and all of these questions around framework, intent, tools, style, they're all the same questions. So if you can resolve them in your playing, you also be able to resolve them for, you know, 100 artists in a room who are all playing together. So that's the side that they are all of a piece and all sort of the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the topic...
It's done weird things, you know, because I was lucky in the autumn before pandemic to be just an intern sort of observer at the ballet in London. I got to follow Barry Wordsworth around. And one of the things that was interesting for me is that because I was doing it at the same time as I was working on the PhD, I got to hear what the inbuilt style of the orchestra of the Royal Opera House is in terms of what their vernacular is. Resonating completely differently.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, fabulous. I remember, it takes me back to studying Lieder deeply in my student days and getting really, really into, like, different, the almost difficult to express different feels or different time signatures or different markings, and you know how like a different instruction on the score can completely change, you know, just the whole feel of it.
Yeah.
And it's not just speed, and it's not just mood, and it's not, it's just, I don't know, there probably are words for it, but you know, there's just something about something that comes beyond, because it's how we interpret these words, isn't it?
Right, absolutely. So we're always refracting. Everything we do is a refraction of, it's an interpretation, which is, you know, Adorno, there was a quotation by Adorno that I never understood, which he says that interpreting language means understanding language, but interpreting music means making music. And the reason I never understood it is because I didn't realize that he was making a definitional difference, right? That when we interpret language, we're taking something in, but when we're interpreting music, we are both taking it in and then feeding it back out. And that's a very different kind of process. So like you say, we're always interpreting in the sense that we interpret language, but then interpreting again as we transmit that back, you know, through our voice or through our instrument or through our orchestra, or however it is we're doing it at the time.
That's interesting. Although I have to say, really good interpreters of language, in particular, I'm particularly thinking of sign language interpreters, can really convey a lot as well when they relay it out again. I've been doing some work with sign language performances, and this is an utter art in itself.
Yeah, it's extraordinary because the communication has to be so dynamic that, you know, you don't have inflection of voice, so you have to inflect your hands or your face, or you know, you do all these other things to create that nonverbal communication. You know, the way in which we communicate when we're speaking or playing an instrument that, you know, you don't get on the page, or that you don't get if you can't hear the sound of your voice or my voice or see us, or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Absolutely. Oh, it really is. But I think that comes from, to me, and as a musician, I always think everything starts with music anyway, but it feels to me like you have to think about interpretation from the perspective of interpreting music to then come to interpretation of language or sign language or you know, that kind of thing as being an artistic output in itself.
Sure. There's one more thing that's related to that, which is that the last thing that came to my attention in Bach and all of sort of the rhetorical music, so all, in, even, you know, beyond into the classical and early, even through the Romantic era, is that these composers had inherited a tradition that was related to speech. And in speech at the time, prosody, so where the stress, where the long and the shorts and the emphasized and the unemphasized were in a sentence or in a discourse or in a, you know, was as important to them overall as it is to us still today in poetry. And just this idea that there were other ways of approaching speech and discourse, both spoken and musical, it was mind-blowing for me. I mean, it totally changed the way in which I understand music to be put together.
Gosh, absolutely.
We'll have to do a podcast about prosody in Bach.
I know. I was like, I don't know whether to delve in or just see it. It's been really brilliant to talk about it. I think we should talk about it again. Definitely. I think we might round it up there. Do you have anything that you would like to plug?
So Lancaster is going to have a great season in person, some of it, and some of it, I think, streamed. So you can find out more at lancasterarts.org. I am hopefully going to launch soon a second recording project to do a few more Bach suites. So that's on the horizon. I've also been thinking about other ways that artists can exist in the world, and so that's also a project that's on the table. Hopefully it'll be live by the time this gets published, and you can put it in the show notes.
There we are, lancasterarts.org.
Yeah, and there's more about me on my website that in which I absolutely have not taken my advice, so it's completely not current. It doesn't talk about any of the things that we've discussed today. And it's best to be an artistic cipher and keep yourself a mystery. No, just kidding.
So that's michaelpohlguitar.com. And also what Michael hasn't said is that you can, of course, listen to his current album, Seven String Bach, on Spotify. So do have a listen to that. Okay, brilliant. Oh, I think we'll stop there.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Kate. It's been wonderful to be here.
Thank you so much for coming and talking to me. Thank you. Bye. Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.